The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ+ community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matters such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, my coverage of the 50th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival continues with a spotlight on three queer filmmakers. That and more next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada. Thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we've made Rainbow Country into a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So today, Academy Award-winning filmmaker Alejandro Amenábar joins me in person to talk about his latest film, The Captive, that tells the real-life story of Miguel de Cervantes, who would go on to write the world-famous novel Don Quixote. And award-winning queer filmmaker Panta Mosley joins me to talk about her involvement in the new film, Eternity, her new documentary, Pride and Prayer, and so much more. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. But first up, award-winning queer filmmaker Breton Hanam joins me to talk about his new queer film, At the Place of Ghosts.
Good evening, everyone. How are you? Oh! You guys are excited, aren't you?
Very exciting night for us.
I'm really freaking excited to be here tonight.
What a great audience.
I'm so excited to be here. It's such a great honor.
I am so honored to be able to show my film to this august crowd.
What's really fun is people who love film, and you are all that, and we're very proud and happy to be here with all of you.
We should not be afraid to tell stories because we are afraid that people will judge.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity and a platform to be able to showcase our work as female filmmakers.
This is for my parents who couldn't come, so thank you. I'm going to prove it to them. I did it!
I've just realized what TIFF actually stands for. Toronto is fucking fantastic.
This is the story of our city, and we're a very proud city, and I want the world to see it.
Hi, Breton. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am well. Your current feature, At the Place of Ghosts. Talk to me about this very entertaining queer horror film. And talk to me about the story that you're telling.
Yeah, it's, I always describe it as, it's just a weird movie. but it's about two estranged siblings that live very different lives. And there's this, you know, terrible dark secret, this traumatic event that has happened in their past. They're sort of haunted by, literally haunted by in this particular movie. And they have to come together, reunite for the first time in a long time in order to go to like the heart of the forest where this traumatic event happened. But it's not an ordinary forest. It's a place where sort of like time and memory are very fluid and flexible. So they end up meeting like their ancestors, their descendants, and themselves as younger people, as kids, leading up to like actually facing this traumatic event so they can sort of repair their relationship and repair their own lives, like, and begin to heal.
So talk to me about that, using flashbacks and the way that you use the flashbacks. How did that all come about? What's the origins of that?
That's a good question. I feel like there's probably 5 different answers I could give, but I'll try to sum it up succinctly into one. It's more sort of like from two main places. One is a little more off the cuff, which is, you know, what if you could meet your younger self and have a conversation with them, like sort of like what would you say? I think people think about that a lot, and I've seen it in some time travel movies, but those are sort of like, if you talk to someone, you change the past, and it becomes really focused on like time, and I'm more focused on people. So it sort of, that's one place that it comes from, and the other is sort of the notion that, you know, your ancestors are behind you. All of your ancestors are behind you. They have sort of made this path that leads to you. So being able to visually enter into a space and interact with them and see them and understand them, that's sort of like the other side of the idea behind that.
The visuals in this film, it's a beautifully shot film. Again, talk to me about the origins of that, how you guys decided how you would shoot this film.
Yeah, I was very lucky in this film because the cinematographer is Guy Godfrey, and I worked with Guy on my first feature, Wildhood, or my previous feature, Wildhood. And we talked about sort of how is this different? Like, what is the visual feel? What is the language? You know, and it's a little maybe cliche to say the forest is a character. I think, you know, that that's tossed around a lot, but it's very much true. I would say the forest is in a way the heart of this film. So when we're filming it, like, there's a lot of thought that went into like just finding parts of the forest that, like, you know, you can feel that are breathing, that are alive. And then as a character in the story, the forest is sort of like bringing to these siblings the things that they need. Sometimes that's the support of their ancestors, and sometimes it's facing this trauma. But it's all sort of like a lot of time went into the location scouting to like find these like really special, secret, beautiful places.
Well said, well said. Like I just said, it's a beautifully shot film. There's one particular scene that I am personally calling Liquid Sky, and it's near the very end of the film where the two characters are in the canoe, the two brothers, and they're, no words are said, they're just in the canoe near the very end of the film. And the way that that film is shot, was that shot in camera or was that done in post? Because it is beautiful.
That's all in camera. That's just a gift. That's a gift from the land.
It's called talent as well. here's my last question for you, and it's 3 quick questions, essentially 1-word answers. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay. Red or white?
Red.
Day or night?
Night.
Wildhood or at the place of ghosts?
Oh, that's a mean one. That's like choosing a favorite child.
Both.
I would say both. Both.
Yes.
Very different children, but I love them both.
Brett and Hanam, thank you so much for your time. Well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Congrats.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
For more on award-winning filmmaker Brett and Hanam's filmography, simply visit letterboxd.com. When I return, queer filmmaker Panta Mosley.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
As a queer Muslim woman from Iran, I have struggled with my faith and believe that Allah would hate me for who I am.
In Iran, we don't have homosexuals.
I'm Middle Eastern, but I'm not comfortable sharing exactly which country I'm from.
It's a country where women have no rights and are murdered or raped with punishments nearly as severe as death for merely showing their hair.
As I stand at the crossroad of my faith and identity, the question looms large. Is it okay to be both queer and Muslim?
The way that I found out about my daughter being queer was absolutely shocking to me.
Shortly after my mom discovered I was queer, we became estranged.
This is my journey to truly accepting who I am, finding my need for validation within myself.
Panta Mosley, hi, how are you?
Fantastic. I mean, I couldn't be any better. I'm a TIFF.
You just said it. TIFF, the 50th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival. You are here because you are part of a film called, what, Eternity?
Yes, it's a...
Eternity. It stars Miles Teller. It stars Elizabeth Olsen. It stars yourself. Talk to me about Eternity and essentially what's this film about?
I don't know how much I'm allowed to say, but basically it's about the afterlife, who they select to, whether they want to be partners with in the afterlife, kind of like the, what was that TV series called? Like The Good Place. It gives off that kind of vibe. And, to be very, very honest, this is going to be the first time I'm going to see the film as well. So I'll be
How did you end up in Eternity?
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I guess just like a lot of other performers that are not like the A-list celebrity where they get offers, I auditioned and I was very, very lucky to be the one, because I think it's just like the draw of the luck. You know, Vancouver has a huge pool of extremely talented performers, and I was just lucky enough to be there right time, right place to do the audition. And I feel very blessed.
Well said to you. Okay, there's another film, a documentary that you wrote, that you direct, a documentary called Pride and Prayer.
Yes.
Pride and Prayer. Talk to me about your film and what is this documentary all about?
Yeah, absolutely. So Pride and Prayer is about my journey into discovering, do I belong in the community, being, you know, growing up a Muslim person and being queer? Is there a space for me in the Muslim community within the religion? Just because, you know, I was like, oh, let me see if I can reconnect with my faith. Is there something? Because, you know, you always want to have community who, regardless of what your background is. And so I kind of was like, let me just dig deep into this and see where it lands and where I land. And, you know, I come from narrative background. So like with narrative background, you have beginning, middle, and end already pre-planned. You know exactly where the story is going to go. Whereas with documentary, you don't necessarily know like what the ending is because you can't like make it. It's just, it is what it is. And it feels like, in a sense, more real as a documentary. And so, you know, my dream was like, oh my God, happy ending. Yes, there's a community. They'll accept me. It doesn't matter. I am who I am. And, you know, unfortunately, through the documentary, I realized it's not as accepted to be queer and Muslim and in the in the community that's a bit more religious. But are there queer Muslim folks? Absolutely. And is it okay to be queer Muslim? I think absolutely, because I mean,
it's their loss.
It's their. Yes, honey, tell them. It's just like, I think, and it's beautifully said in the documentary by my mom as well. You are who you are. And, you know, as long as I'm not hurting anybody, it's my life and my choice. And, I think it's between, at the end of the day, between me and God.
What's the origin of your film, your documentary? How did this come about? Was this something that was brewing inside you to make? Because
yeah,
it's essentially your story. So
yeah,
where does this come from?
It ended up being a very like more of a mother-daughter relationship, reconnecting with my family more than anything, because I had not been in touch with my mom for like 6 years because of like, you know, coming out and not being accepted and time and her having a wonderful, lovely lesbian best friend teaching her a lot of things. I think it kind of helped reshape her way of thinking, because she was also growing up in a very conservative, like, you know, not super conservative, but more conservative Muslim family. And my dad is a bit more conservative. And, you know, growing up in Iran, like, one, the government thinks that, you know, at the time they thought that like there's no gay people in Iran. I'm like, well, hey, I think it's otherwise. But it's like you grow up thinking that it's wrong, it's a sin, it's bad. If you have those thoughts, it's not okay. And so I was like, well, but if, you know, if we are made in the image of God, if it is says I'm made, I am this. So what do you mean? There's no mistakes. I'm made like this. And let me see if I can reconnect with my faith. And let me see. I just wanted validation for who I am, I think, and to find the community to connect to, and hopefully show people that, hey, you're not alone. Love yourself. Be proud, loud, proud, and openly who you are. And hopefully this will help me find a community, or this will help somebody else feel like, oh my God, I'm not alone. And so that was really where the idea stemmed of like, let me look into this. Let me like, you know, see, I don't think, personally, I don't think I'm in the wrong. I feel like you like who you like, and I'm, you know what I mean? It's not like it's a choice. It's just how I am. It's not like I made a decision of like, I am going to now like women, or like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, you like who you like. Mm-hmm. And I love to reach the day where we're just like, hey, I'm Panta Muslim. Don't even have to say I'm queer. Don't even have to say anything. I'm just Panta. Wouldn't that be great?
So, well, from your lips to God's ears.
Hey.
So in the summer of 2025, you launched your comedy show, Culture Shock.
Yes.
I believe on Prime Video. Talk to me about Culture Shock and what is this about?
Absolutely. So it actually stems from Pride and Prayer, because in Pride and Prayer, part of the treatment that I had was to kind of do like a fun comedy show that is kind of like talking about my coming out story, because I didn't come out. My mom walked in on me. True story. That's how she found out, poor thing. But it was basically doing a comedy show and kind of like getting it out there and talking about it publicly for the first time ever in front of my mom in the audience. And I was like, you know what, let me make this into like a full comedy show. It's still the same budget. I still have to get a venue. I still have to do a show. So I ended up with the permission of the funding bodies and also the distributor for the comedy show. I was like, can I use this in my documentary? And also, hey, documentary, is it okay if I have this as a separate project to sell? It was all okay. Two thumbs up for that. So I was like, okay, great. So I got a lineup of diverse comedians, whether it be their neurodivergent or different backgrounds, or just a lineup of like diverse comedians that are also went through similar things. And I made a whole show out of it. It actually got wonderful profits on the back end. Right now the documentary is in festival circuit, so who knows if it gets if it gets picked up by a network, then that will be profit too. But more importantly, that's just the story, and it wasn't for money. But the comedy show, I'm like, listen, you're gonna make some money back. And it was really fun because it was my mom in the audience, like just listening and watching her laugh at the jokes that I made about how she found out by walking in on us. It was just really fun, and the audience took it well, and it got like it's doing well. Like even the promo clip on my Instagram had like 37,500 views. I'm like, oh my god, I didn't think people would watch it. Like so, I was very pleasantly surprised.
You just said your mom walked in on you. I think a lot of LGBT people can relate to a family member finding out about them in that specific way. Talk to me about your experience. Like, what happened?
Oh my goodness. You know, a lot of, like, maybe some people get walked in on, but also I feel like a lot of people are, at least in movies, they're like, mom or dad, sit down. I want to talk to you. I don't know if you're ready for this. And, you know, they mentally prepare them, and then they kind of like have a beautiful coming out. Me and my mom didn't have that. My dad was in Iran at the time, and they were separated. Walked in, it was what's that noise kind of moment, and lifts the blanket and is like, oh, where is your hand? And I'm like, oh. And it was kind of like it was literally a movie moment. And it gets worse. It gets really worse, because it was like, you know, like the initial reaction that she had, she's like, slaps me, and I'm like, ah. And then I just like reactively go like this, and I hit her back, and I'm like, oh, we both look at each other, because one, Middle Eastern family, you never touch your mama. You get the whooping. You never kind of like react back. And I was just like, then I realized what happened, and then she realized what happened, but then we realized that it was with the wrong hand that was doing the business, and we're like, so that happened.
Oh my god.
So I don't know if everybody has had that experience, but we talked about that in the we didn't go into that much detail in the documentary. I did that in the comedy set. She was a good sport. She laughed about it at the comedy set and even heckled me, which was really fun. Because like I think in the comedy set moment, I was like, yeah, you know, in Middle Eastern, West Asian families, it's the parents that do the whooping. And she's like, yes, it's true. I was like, oh my god, don't tell people you whoop me. She's like, proudly, yes. Yeah. That was really fun.
So Panta, you are a filmmaker, you're a comedian, you're an actor, you're a director. For you, where do you feel most comfortable? You feel most comfortable doing what?
To be honest, everything started and stemmed from acting, because I was living in Japan for 6-7 years, and then I came to Canada 2013 or 14, and that's where I decided, okay, I want to be in film, and it's very hard to do that in Japan. I had two radio shows there, but I was like, okay, if TV doesn't work out, I'm gonna come to the hub in Canada for film, which is either Vancouver or Toronto, and Vancouver was closer to where my mom had a place in Victoria, and I was like, great. I came to Vancouver, and just it was tough. It was tough to get in, get your foot through the door, and I had money saved up from the radio show that I had, and I ended up buying a camera that was really cool at the time, and then I would rent it out to productions, undercutting the rental houses. And I was like, but the thing is, you gotta hire me with it. And the productions would be like, well, do you know how to operate the camera? And I'd be like, no. So ended up, I like through that route, I got into the camera trainee program. I did it with the Disney movie called Zapped with Zendaya. at that time. And I did second AC work for, I think, a year, year and a half. And then I moved into production coordinating. I did that for about like 6 years. And then I did production managing for docuseries for MGM's on MGM's streaming platform called Epix. And then I moved to like indie producing, and I was like, wait, what did I start this whole thing for? And it was acting, because meanwhile, I was still acting. I had an agent, I was acting here and there, but you still have to sustain yourself, because acting doesn't always pay the bills unless you're like an A-lister or series like regular. So you still have to have something that will complement you financially so you can follow that dream. And eventually, after producing like some indie projects, I was like, oh my God, this is all logistics. And I started this as an acting. And why did I start in acting? Because I like telling stories. And so I landed on directing. And I was like, oh, this feels nice. I feel at home with this. And it goes really nicely hand in hand with acting, because you're still in there telling the story. You're working with the actors. So I would say like acting and directing would be my biggest passions that I have. Initially it was acting, and now it's kind of both acting and directing. And I've been very blessed to kind of keep working in the industry where things have slowed down, but I'm super lucky, knock on wood, to keep working. That's pretty much how I landed where I landed.
So for yourself, with everything that you just said, what's been some of the biggest challenges, the biggest hurdles that you've come across time and time again, but especially as a queer creative and mm-hmm. wanting to tell stories and maybe even wanting to tell personal stories? What have been some of the challenges that you've come across?
Yeah, that's a very a very good question, and very like heavy feelings I have with the answer for that. It's like, first, when I came to Canada, to even get an agent was very hard, because like at the time it was before the 2016 whole BIPOC movement, and it was like straight up, a lot of the agents would be like, well, there's not a lot of roles for you. It's gonna be very hard for us to get you out there. So I got a lot of no's before even anybody considering me, which was very hard to swallow for someone who has like dreams and hopes, and you need someone on your corner to push for you, because like we can't get auditions, it's the agents that get the auditions for you. But that didn't stop me. I think it was more like I kept creating my own content. I was like, okay, if no one's going to give me a chance, I'm going to create my own chance and show them that, hey, these are the roles that I can do. And then it kind of like all piled up together, and ended up I work behind the scene and in front of the scene, so that worked out really well. And for the other part for your question, like as a queer content creator, I feel a lot of networks, I don't think there's enough queer content on regular Canadian linear network, to be very, very honest, because like, or even for funding, they don't always fund a lot of the queer stuff, because they're like, oh, well, maybe this has been kind of done before. I'm like, really? Have you had a series with a Persian Kurdish leading actress in a half hour comedy show in Canada? Maybe not a lot, maybe like one or two. They're like, yeah, but like, you know, for example, a cool show like Sort Of. I'm like, oh, okay, so is that the only show that
exactly.
You know what I'm saying? I love all the Canadian networks, and I love Sort Of, and it was so amazing and so unique. But it's like, it shouldn't be the only BIPOC show and queer show. You should have so much more like it, because we don't have, there's so many procedurals. You don't say, oh, well, we have one procedural, we don't want to do another one.
It's like, well, not everything needs to be drag.
No, exactly. And it's kind of like there's other stuff. You can have an asexual show, you can pansexual, you can have poly, exactly. You can have bi, you can have, you know, lesbian, gay.
Or you can just have, you know, a show like The Office, but there are people that are part of the LGBT community, and you know, they're talking about what happened on the weekend.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be a show that's fully focused on it's a queer
exactly.
show. It can just be a show that leads are just queer and just happen to be queer and all the colors of the rainbow here. And we don't have that. No matter how many times they're like, well, this has kind of been done before. It's like, no, it hasn't. No, it hasn't. And you need to have so much more of it on camera. So I would say that's the most difficult thing, because like, again, I just had, I had submitted my project to get more funding from the Canadian Media Fund. And they're like, well, this is, you know, some of the feedback was like, it's very like a Canadian content. It's not as like, you know, it needs to have like more stuff, like, you know. And I'm like, well, I haven't seen something with an Iranian leading character. queer, a queer Muslim girl falling in love with a queer Jewish girl. I haven't seen a story like that. Why are we not having more of the stories? Like, let's just have I don't think we discriminate as much with the straight cisgender roles as we do with the queer. You know what I'm getting at, right?
I hear you.
You know, and it's like all the networks. Yeah. I can't pinpoint. So I'm so lucky to have support from Out TV and Hollywood Suite, and they're wonderful, right? But they're channels for queer people. Why are we just boxing us into those channels? Why can't there be bigger networks, the Craves, the CBCs that have more of our content on your regular channels? And unfortunately, CBC Gem is kind of gone. So the Gem originals are no longer a thing. So there's not a lot of outlets for us. Yeah. That's the biggest challenge, I would say.
Yeah, I hear you. Here's my last question for you. And it's three quick questions.
Ooh, rapid fire.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Red or white?
Oh my gosh, that's a hard question. Oh my god. Rapid fire. Red. That was the first one that came to mind, so I should have said that.
Day or night?
Day.
Culture shock or Pride and Prayer?
Oh, Pride and Prayer, because it's at VQFF. You should go watch it. Ow. But also go see Culture Shock on Amazon.
Well said. Well said, Panta Mosley. Well said. Well done. Well filmed. Well created. Well everything. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Absolutely. Such a pleasure to get to chat with you. And hopefully I get to see, I don't know if you're going to come to Vancouver Queer Film Festival, but if you do, I hope to see you there.
As a queer Muslim woman from Iran, I have struggled with my faith and believe that Allah would hate me for who I am.
In Iran, we don't have homosexuals.
I'm Middle Eastern, but I'm not comfortable sharing exactly which country I'm from.
It's a country where women have no rights and are murdered or raped, with punishments nearly as severe as death for merely showing their hair. As I stand at the crossroad of my faith and identity, the question looms large. Is it okay to be both queer and Muslim?
The way that I found out about my daughter being queer was absolutely shocking to me.
Shortly after my mom discovered I was queer, we became estranged. This is my journey to truly accepting who I am, finding my need for validation within myself.
For more on award-winning filmmaker Panta Mosley, simply visit pkstudioproductions.com. Coming up next, Academy Award winner Alejandro Amenábar.
Hi, I'm Agnes. My new record, Magic Still Exists, is out now. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is gay hip-hop artist, the Mangfather Bob Katz. An artist friend of mine recommended that I check out Mark Tara's Rainbow Country years ago, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Mark's excellent interviews highlight all aspects of the LGBTQ community, and he's not afraid to ask the difficult questions that other hosts avoid. And I love, love, love the music that Mark plays on Rainbow Country each week, especially when he plays my music. But seriously, Mark Tara has been such a supporter of my music and has turned me on to so many great LGBTQ artists that I'd never heard of before. I'm so grateful to Mark Tara's Rainbow Country.
So I wanted to take this time to let you know about the next evolution of Rainbow Country, simply called Rainbow Country Plus, streaming 24/7 on YouTube. It's currently live, and to check it out, simply head over to marktara.ca, where, of course, everything is connected, and hit the poster. It's right there. It's simple, and of course, it's free. And currently features interviews from filmmakers that have been part of the Toronto International Film Festival that have had the honor of interviewing. So I hope you'll take a little time and check it out. Rainbow Country Plus, the next evolution of this little gay radio show.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And of course our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So support, tune in. Thank you.
I'm Billy Newton Davis, and we're sitting here on Rainbow Country with the fabulous Mark Tara.
Alejandro Amenabar, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
We are here at the 50th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival to talk about your new film, in English, The Captive. How do you say it? What's the original title?
Yes, it, in Spanish is El Cautivo. In English, the translation, literal translation, would be The Captive.
You direct this film, you produce this film, you wrote this film, you did the musical score for this film. Talk to me about essentially the story that you're telling in The Captive.
Well, it's the story of Miguel de Cervantes, who was a writer who did Don Quixote of La Mancha. Was curious about his story and tried to learn about his personality, because at some point I wondered, this guy who ended up writing one of the most famous novels in time, what kind of guy this would be? So I didn't want just to do the typical biopic. He was born, he grew up, he died. I wanted just to focus in a part of his life, trying to get to know his soul. So that was my process during all these years.
How long did it take you to make this film?
Since I started seriously writing the script, that was like 2 years ago, although I started to research about him 8 years ago. So let's say that the production of the film has taken me 2 years. And it's been a good process. Well, we had some financial problems at some point, but I was able to keep my freedom in order to tell this story with no restriction at all.
Religion plays a big part of this story. Finding religion, holding on to religion, losing religion, converting from one religion to the other. My understanding of yourself is you were raised Catholic, mm-hmm. and then became agnostic, and then became
an atheist.
An atheist. So your personal spiritual journey, religious journey, did that influence you wanting to make this particular film?
I think that religion is all over the places, with in different levels. But in Spain, of course, we are a country where Christianity had a lot of influence, and I was raised in a religious school, so I was pretty familiar. I'm pretty familiar with all the dogmas, and I remember since I was a child, I started to question some of those dogmas and to question myself, and that of course has been in my work somehow. I wouldn't say that this movie is trying to talk about religion, but it is true that when you look back at the story of Cervantes and this particular time in his life, life, he had to deal with his greatest enemy in that prison where he was captured in the 16th century in Algiers, and he was a priest who accused him of being a sodomite. So I understood that religion was going to be part of this story because it was in real life.
Okay, so you started making films when you were fairly young, like I believe in your 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And you made your third film, I guess, in your late 20s, early 30s?
I think my third film must have been The Others.
The Others.
Because that movie took us a while, because Nicole Kidman had an injury in her knee when she was doing Moulin Rouge, so we have to wait for a few months more. So I think I started it in my late 20s, of course.
So you just said Nicole Kidman, one of the producers, Tom Cruise, another one, Harvey Weinstein,
mm-hmm.
the Weinstein Corporation, the brothers. Back in 2001, looking back from where you are now, what did that experience teach you about making films, like especially being part of, you know, the big Hollywood machine, like Tom Cruise being one of the producers, Harvey Weinstein, Nicole Kidman, dealing with, you know, the top of Hollywood? What did that teach you back then?
That I was pretty mad.
You were mad.
I must have been, in order to deal with them, almost sometimes without realizing how powerful they are, and that's something undeniable. They are. So I'm talking about, particularly about Tom and Nicole, they're so talented. And for me, I was a child, really. I was a kid. And I had to learn about the process of how things go in Hollywood, because I never wanted The Others to be a Hollywood picture. I wanted to keep control of the story that I wanted to tell. And sometimes you have little fights, sometimes or battles, sometimes you have bigger battles. But the thing that led me all the time wasn't even my future as a filmmaker. I just was focused on the story that I wanted to tell. And of course, working with someone as Nicole, who is so incredibly talented, I learned a lot about directing actresses, directing actors, and even directing stars, why not saying. For me, it was a really, really very, very intense experience.
Intense good? Intense both good and bad?
Well, in intense experiences, you have dark moments, and I have to deal with that, but it makes you stronger. So I'm when I look back, I'm surprised that little kid was able to make his point sometimes when we have some cute battles taking place.
So The Others, I love that film. I own that film, just so that you know. Okay, 2005, Best International Feature Film, and the Oscar goes to you. Talk to me about The Sea Inside and winning the Oscar for Best International Feature. Did you go into that thinking that you might win? Were you surprised? When they called your name, mm-hmm. and the film, what went through your mind?
Well, I have to say first that winning an Oscar is, because it's like in such an iconic award, that is something that we all dream about. Especially if you're a kid, as I was, obsessed with movies, and at some point you see yourself holding an Oscar, but then the reality arrives to your life, and you see how difficult and tricky that is. I don't think I was thinking on an Oscar when I decided to tell this story after having made The Others, tell this apparently little story, about this guy who was asking for euthanasia because he was quadriplegic. And I did it with all my mind, with all my heart. I really loved the story, and I wanted to do a very emotional movie. And at some point, we found ourselves in the route towards the Oscar, I remember you have to go there to Los Angeles. You have to be at the meetings. You have to present your movie.
You have to campaign.
You have to campaign, and that's a lot of work. And that's really what weighs on your shoulders when you're about to be at the ceremony, because you think, oh, my God, after all the efforts, we might not win. But then I think it's important not only winning, but learning how to lose. That was one of those great moments when I was the fortunate among those five directors who got the Oscar. But I think I've learned in time that it's important to let it go, an award, when you simply don't get it. I don't remember what I thought when they called my name. I think I was so anxious and so, I don't know, that I just got there and said by heart all the speech that I've learned by heart at that moment.
Did winning the Oscar change your life?
No, I think, as I said, it's such an iconic award that gives you some consideration from people around you, people in the industry. But let's say that I didn't allow it to change my life, because my life was always Madrid in Spain, being surrounded by my relatives, my friends, and being able to tell my stories wherever they take me. Sometimes I have to go. I came here to Toronto to shoot the story, and I've been also in Malta shooting another story. So I just focus on my movies and try to stay aware of all that might surround the Oscars fever.
So, needless to say, you are a very successful filmmaker. You are an Oscar winner. Your films have explored themes like identity, morality, sexuality. You're also an openly gay man, and you're a filmmaker. Do you feel more comfortable today telling stories, LGBT stories, queer stories, in your films today than, say, maybe you did in 2005 or 2001? Do you feel more comfortable telling a story and showing what you're showing, especially in The Captive, today than maybe you would have like 20 years ago?
The thing is, there is like find for me irony in this, and that is that I decided to come out of the closet, let's say, when I was in my 30s, because I was very reluctant for people to get involved in my private life, but at the same time, I don't feel bad about it. So I wanted to be open about it. I thought it was better to saying it then than when I'm 80 years old, you know, saying, oh, I was gay. I think it was important to say that moment, and also because it can help some other people to come out and tell to their parents, for instance. So I thought it was important to say it. But I didn't feel the call in my movies to express it. And that's why there was almost no gay characters or gay plots in my movies before. Sometimes my gay friends or even journalists said, why, what are you waiting for in order to tell a gay story? And I said, it's not something that I feel like doing. But exploring the life of Miguel de Cervantes, I found this very important element in his story. And then I thought, okay, now it's the moment. I feel totally connected with what's going on to him, and having run away from it would have been denying my own nature. So I thought that was, to now it was the moment to openly talk about homosexuality.
Do you think you could have made this film, like, say, 10 years ago? Especially with the gay aspect of it.
What I wonder is whether it would be possible to do it in 15 years in the future. Because, sometimes you can feel that things are changing and not for better. I would like to think that, let's at least in Spanish society, 15 years ago, Of course, it would have been, there would have been maybe more controversy because it's he's in Spanish icon, as our best, our most important writer. But I would like to think that I would have been able to produce it and to do it. Homophobia exists in every time, in every place, at least something's a hint of it, but it exists. And in this movie, it's going to be a good, I don't know if you use the same word here, thermometer, you know, to see if sexual diversity is normal in our society. We'll see what happens.
Okay, so here's my last question for you, and it's three quick questions. Basically, one-word answers, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Red or white?
White.
Day or night?
Day.
The sea inside or the captive?
The sea inside. Okay. Yeah, I thought you were going to say The Sea Inside or The Others, which are my two favorite films and the most.
Oh, okay.
And that would have been a tricky question because I don't know which one I like the better.
Okay, so then The Sea Inside or The Others, which one do you like better?
Since I'm in an English-speaking land, I would say The Others.
I have to say thank you so much for your time. Well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Keep your ears and eyes open for Academy Award-winning filmmaker Alejandro Amenábar's The Captive, because when it does come out, you'll definitely want to check it out. For more on his filmography, simply visit letterboxd.com.
Magnus Hirschfeld made the modern homosexual. He co-founded the world's first gay rights group, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, in Berlin in 1897. But what is far more important is that he and his colleagues came up with an enormously influential concept of what same-sex desire was, what it meant, and how it fit into the wider world. If you think homosexuality is an inborn quality that cannot be changed and has a biological root, but is not an illness, and if you think gay people are a sexual minority who are born that way, and who deserve legal protections just as racial minorities do, you owe those ideas to Hirschfeld and a handful of others. He was among the first to articulate that conceptual model of what it means to be gay in print in 1896.
We just heard professor, author, and historian of queer and trans politics, Lori Marhoefer, reading from Racism and the Making of Gay Rights, a sexologist, his student, and the Empire of Queer Love, their powerful new gay history book about the man who made the modern homosexual, a German physician and sexologist who died at the age of 67 in 1935, Magnus Hirschfeld.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, I'm Justin Ling, author of Missing from the Village. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country. Bryan Adams, number one, Studio 54, disco hit. 1979's Let Me Take You Dancing.
Hi, I'm Gord Depp of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is hour two of Rainbow Country, where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. So if you stay with me, if you stick with me, I hope you think bringing you music worth hearing. Starting us off, an 80s set.